On November 9th through the 11th, the Federal Society hosted the 2023 National Lawyers Convention in Washington, D.C. This year's theme was Originalism on the Ground, and it featured many excellent speeches, debates, and discussion panels covering a wide range of important legal and policy issues. This recording comes from that event, and we hope you enjoy it.
I'm John Richter. I chair the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Executive Committee, and it's my pleasure to be able to introduce Amul Thapar. Judge Thapar, really number one claim to fame is that he was nominated to be United States Attorney the same day that I was. But for his nomination, I'm pretty sure I probably never would have gotten through the Senate, but we were a package deal, and the skids were greased. The other thing I'd say, obviously, about Judge Thapar, of course, is having served on the district court and on the Court of Appeals, and having been an assistant United States attorney in two different districts, as well as obviously United States attorney, he brings a wealth of background and experience, a practical as well as obviously all of his teaching and whatnot. Finally, I think my closest connection to Judge Thapar is he's reputed to have made at least according to Wikipedia, because that's where I do my research, he's reputed to have made a reference in a decision describing fraud as essentially if a bar serves Pappy Van Winkle, says they serve Pappy Van Winkle, but is in fact serving Old Crow, that is fraud, that is truly Kentuckian. And I can tell you, given that my next door neighbor is Julian Van Winkle, it would be a travesty. So without further ado, let me introduce Judge Thapar. I will say for CLE purposes, if you're pursuing that, obviously if you want to get credit, you need to go in and sign in and out each day. You can also do it, I think there are QR codes somewhere. Make sure that if you've not checked in, you scan the QR code on the back of your convention booklet or one of the posters. I think there will be a code at the end of this, so I believe Judge Thapar will read out to you. Finally, I do want to emphasize that obviously the practice groups, including the criminal law and procedure practice groups, are open for business. We urge your participation and interest in those. And then, as I understand, I'm told that I'm supposed to also announce some kind of bus schedule, because there's really no task too small. If you've got tickets for the Scalia Memorial Dinner, the location, of course, is at the Washington Hilton. And shuttle buses to the Hilton, evidently from here, run starting at 5:15 and run till 6:30 every 5 minutes. The pickup, I believe, is on DeSales Street on the side. So without further ado, Judge Thapar, thank you.
Thank you, John. And I think it was the other way around. I only got through because I rode your coattails. But it's an honor to be here with this amazing panel. I think you're going to really like it. Each of the panelists is going to talk for 5 to 10 minutes. We'll keep it short, so we can have some dialogue amongst the panel and then question and answer. I want to emphasize one thing about questions. The sentence always, there's no exceptions, ends with a question mark. And so I want to be very clear that judges are good at cutting people off. That's why they let us be moderators. So you can get up and ask a question, but if you make a speech, you will sit down, okay? Or you can exit stage right. So please get up and ask questions. We encourage it, but questions only. So first, I would like to introduce John Bash. And John is the co-chair of the National Appellate Practice and co-managing partner of the Austin office of Quinn Emanuel. At one point, he held the job that John and I both call the greatest job in the world, not John Bash, but John Richter and I. But John Bash says it's an okay job, and working in the SG's office was much better.
I feel like I used a stronger word than okay. Good job.
He was the United States Attorney for the Western District of Texas from 2017 to 2020. As I mentioned, he was also assistant to the Solicitor General. He clerked on the Circuit Court for Judge Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court for Justice Scalia. Next to him, going second, is Michael Caruso. Michael Caruso is the federal public defender, which I can tell you, like the U.S. attorney, is an extremely important job, probably harder in many ways, but in both jobs, you have a lot of responsibility. And one of the cool things he's done, and their bios are available to you, but I'm just emphasizing a few things, is he was lead counsel in the criminal case against Jose Padilla in the Southern District of Florida. And before his indictment, for the many of you that are too young to remember this, he was being held as an enemy combatant under an executive order signed by President Bush. Caruso, obviously in his job as the federal public defender, not only manages the office, but represents many individual clients and serves on many local and national committees that advocate for criminal justice reform. He earned his law degree from the University of Florida Law School and clerked for Judge Locke on the United States District Court for the Southern District of Florida. Next to him and going third is Professor Meg Ryan. Professor Ryan is the co-director of the Sy Center for Law, Science, and Innovation, Altshuler Distinguished Teaching Professor and Professor of Law at Southern Methodist University. All of those words say to me she's just really smart. She's an award-winning teacher and scholar at the intersection of criminal law and procedure, torts, and law and science. One of the important things about her is she practiced at Dorsey and Whitney. I love professors that actually practiced law and were in the courtroom. And she focused her practice on, among other things, commercial and intellectual property litigation and white-collar defense and compliance. Before joining SMU, she was a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law, where she taught criminal law, crim pro, and sales. Last but not least is Professor John Stiniford. He's the Edward Rood Eminent Scholar Chair, Professor of Law, and Senior Fellow, Hamilton Center for Classical and Civic Education, Levin College of Law, University of Florida. Again, that just means smart. I wish they would shorten their titles and just say smart professor of law. His work has been cited numerous times by the United States Supreme Court, several state Supreme Courts, federal courts of appeal, and numerous scholars. Like his fellow professor, he also practiced in the courtroom and he practiced both at Winston and Strawn and as an assistant United States attorney, which is also an amazing job. And he teaches first-year courses in crim law and con law and upper-level courses in many things, including criminal procedure and federal criminal law and white-collar crime. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to John.
Thank you, Judge, and thanks, everybody, for being here. So I think our prompt is criminal law in the wake of Dobbs. So Dobbs being the abortion decision, if anyone in the room is not aware of the title. And I guess I'll just start by completely reversing the framing of that and talking briefly about Dobbs in the wake of criminal procedure. Because, you know, I think the mode of analysis where precedents were questioned and overruled based on originalist understanding really started with criminal procedure. As I'm sure you all know, for many years, Justice Scalia and then eventually Justice Thomas were kind of lone voices in favor of originalist understandings in various cases. But they actually started translating those into wins essentially by joining with more liberal-leaning members of the court in the area of criminal procedure. And I'll just give some examples of that. Justice Scalia, I think, had said that one of his two favorite majority opinions was Crawford versus Washington, which is the opinion that, in his view at least, restored the original understanding of the Confrontation Clause, which entitles criminal defendants to confront witnesses against them. And in a case called Ohio versus Roberts in the early 90s, the Supreme Court had essentially said, well, you sort of have a right to confront, but if there's indicia of reliability for the out-of-court statement that was not confronted, that's okay too. And via a sort of balancing test, practical analysis had, on some views, watered down the confrontation right. In Crawford versus Washington in 2004, the Supreme Court overruled Ohio versus Roberts and said, no, under the original understanding, the right to confrontation means the right not to have unconfronted hearsay, testimonial hearsay, used against you in court. And so unless it falls into a historical exception or is not testimonial, which was a concept explored in later cases, or you had an opportunity to confront before trial, you can't use those statements. And what's telling about Crawford, and we'll be telling about all the cases I'll mention, is that it was a coalition between the more liberal members of the court that probably did not have methodological commitments to the originalist analysis, but probably liked the outcome in that it was protective of defendants' rights. And Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, who didn't have necessarily a predisposition to protect defendants' rights in the abstract, but understood the Confrontation Clause to mean something historically and enforced that. And Crawford itself, as I mentioned, has spawned a whole line of precedent, which are kind of interesting if you're an originalist, because Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas have diverged on certain questions about what counts as testimonial and so forth. So it's an interesting line, but that whole line of relatively important criminal procedure precedents has been completely subsumed in an originalist analysis, which is not necessarily true of all other areas. I know you all will talk about the Eighth Amendment, which still is pretty non-originalist in that it's about changing mores and so forth. So that's one. I think that's the most prominent example, but there are others. One really watershed originalist Scalia-Thomas liberal coalition is Apprendi versus New Jersey. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. It was a 2000 case that said essentially any fact that increases the maximum sentence someone can receive in court must be proved to a jury. And that immediately, not in that case, but in two later cases called Blakely and Booker, essentially meant that the guideline systems that states and the federal government had established for criminal sentencing were unconstitutional. Under those systems, if your statutory range was, say, 0 to 20 years, the systems would say, well, if the judge doesn't find some fact like you did it with a gun, actually you can only be sentenced to 10 years. For the judge to sentence you in the upper area of the statutory range, he or she needs to find that you did it with a gun or did it with some other aggravating circumstance. And the court said that's unconstitutional because those facts are now necessary for your upper range sentence, and if they're necessary, they must be found by a jury. And there's now been a whole line of Apprendi cases feeding off that originalist analysis and saying, well, what about criminal forfeiture? What about penalties? What about all these other things? And then it even extended ultimately to mandatory minimums, which Justice Scalia was not willing to extend it to, but Justice Thomas was. But all of that essentially derived from the views of Justice Scalia and Thomas that under the 19th century understanding of what a crime is, every fact that increased the sentence was an element of the crime. And so when you put that into the jury trial right, every fact that increases the maximum has to be proved to the jury. It was a very originalist analysis, vigorously objected to by the more practical right-leaning members of the court, like Justice Kennedy, Chief Justice Rehnquist. But again, it was Justices Scalia and Thomas joining with liberals who presumably liked the outcome to enmesh an originalist mode of reasoning into an important area of criminal procedure. I'll just give two others and then quickly say a couple points about the implications of this. The Fourth Amendment. A lot of you probably know a case called Kylo, which was about whether the police officers need a warrant, or whether it's a search at least, to use a heat-seeking device to obtain information about the interior of a home. And Justice Scalia wrote the opinion, joined by liberal members of the court, and said, you know, Katz, this 1960s standard about reasonable expectation of privacy, is sort of circular, it's very hard to apply, but in this case it's easy, because at common law, you at minimum had a reasonable expectation that the government could not pry into the interior of your home, at least without a warrant. And so we're going to, once, just because you have new technology, if you're achieving the same thing that was forbidden at common law, it's forbidden here. The other Fourth Amendment case that's important in this area is Jones from 2012. And in Jones, the question was, can the police attach something to your car without a warrant that tracks your movements on public streets? And in a Warren Court era Katz analysis, there would be a debate about, well, you know, you can see people driving on the streets, so why is it an invasion of privacy just to track you on public streets? That's, you're doing that in public. But what Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas and the liberals again said, well, I think it was a broader coalition in Jones, if I'm remembering correctly, what they said was that, forget all that, putting the thing on the car is a trespass at common law, period. So it doesn't matter privacy expectations on the streets. It's a trespass at common law to put it on the car. That's it. That's a search. You need a warrant. And the last area I'll mention, it's pseudo-originalist, is the emergence or reemergence in recent years of the vagueness doctrine for criminal statutes. So I had the misfortune of arguing in the Supreme Court a case called United States versus Johnson, which was about something called the residual clause of the Armed Career Criminal Act, which I'll oversimplify, but it enhanced criminal penalties if they could show you committed a prior criminal offense that had a high chance of violence, or I can't remember the language now, but it was something super vague. And the court had struggled with lots of cases about whether certain sorts of prior offenses qualified under this vague language, and the issue in Johnson was whether mere possession of a sawed-off shotgun counted. I argued for the government that it did count. I like to think I was so persuasive, but that outcome seemed so crazy that the court decided to just strike the entire statute down as unconstitutionally vague, which Justice Scalia had been pushing for a long time, and that arises out of traditional originalist notions of due process and fair notice in criminal statutes. So the broader point I want to make is in all these areas, essentially Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas's views about the correct way to conduct constitutional interpretation, which didn't really have a majority of the court at the time, made their way into majority opinions because liberal justices who didn't appear to have any commitment to that style of reasoning wanted the vote. I don't want to psychoanalyze them, but they joined votes on methodological grounds they otherwise didn't endorse, presumably because they liked the rule of law coming out of those cases. That, in some sense, at least doctrinally, laid the groundwork for the current more controversial cases like Dobbs, where the court has used originalist arguments and reasoning to overrule long settled or 50 years settled precedents. And what that it now doesn't look so weird that that's happening. I mean, imagine there hadn't been Crawford, there hadn't been Apprendi, there hadn't been these cases. All of a sudden, the court's overruling precedents based on their view of the original understanding. It looks a lot more anomalous in that situation, whereas now you can point to Crawford and Apprendi and Jones and Kylo and all these cases and say, we're just doing what we always do. When something's clearly wrong on the originalist understanding, we have overruled precedents, and Dobbs is not anomalous in that respect. And so the interesting question for me going forward is, do the liberal justices feel like they or their predecessors made a mistake in joining some of those opinions? They could have concurred in the judgment and said, I don't agree with looking at 19th century sources about the jury trial right or the confrontation right, but the rule is correct for these other reasons that appeal more to my sensibility. Because now it's defensible to say, hey, in Dobbs, we're just doing what we did in Crawford. We're just doing what we did in a lot of these cases. And I wonder if going forward, the liberal justices will be more reluctant to sign on to originalist analysis, even in cases they agree with, for fear of, you know, establishing more precedent of that originalism can overrule precedent. So that's my opening spiel, and I guess I'll turn it back over to the judge.
Michael?
Thank you, Judge, and thank you, John, for inviting me to participate in this panel. There aren't many groups that appreciate the views of public defenders, so I do appreciate the Federalist Society for inviting me here today. I don't think it's an accident, however, that a bright light is shining in my face, like my clients would be subjected to in the 19th. Yes, of course. And just the reason why, you know, police officers shine that light in a suspect's face during interrogation was to get the truth out of them, right? So I'm going to tell you that's going to work today. I'm going to try to tell the truth as much as I can.
Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Never. Socialist Party, yes. Not the Communist Party. So, you know, I'm going to take, as a public defender, I'm going to take a more cynical view than my friend John here. So I do agree that those cases did make strange bedfellows, right? And it is clearly Justices Scalia and Thomas that led that those original interpretations with regard to those cases. You know, whether the liberal justices regret signing on to those opinions, whether they'll be hesitant to sign on in the future. I don't know. It seems like we're in a different Supreme Court world where every case generates, you know, a majority opinion, two concurrences, and numerous dissents. So I think there's room for multiple interpretations. And, we actually saw that in a case I think a few of us are going to discuss today, Ramos, a case that involved the jury unanimity requirement of the Constitution, overruled a case that I think was 4-1-4, but overruled it also in a fractured opinion, with which Justice Alito pointed the irony out in his dissent. But my bottom line cynical view is that the criminal procedure cases that John talked about and the Dobbs decision really are not related. My view is that Dobbs occurred because the court got to 5, right? I think there was an agenda, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. There was a conservative legal and political agenda from the day after Roe was issued to have that decision overruled. And again, that's not pejorative. That's every American's right to try to change the law the way that he or she sees fit. But we had Roe for many, many years, and then we had Casey, again, a fractured opinion. But of course, Casey predates Crawford and Apprendi and Kylo and Jones. And now we have Dobbs. And I think, for me, sort of the confluence between the Dobbs decision and criminal procedure cases going forward is the Louisiana versus Ramos case that predated Dobbs by a couple of years. And you can say, we have Supreme Court clerks here. What the justices are very good at, I'm going to say the conservative justices more so, is playing the long game, right? So after, Casey, because Casey is a case about two different issues, right? Abortion rights and precedent. And in fact, and this is, I would be interested to hear the judge's view on this, or the audience's view, and my co-panelists as well. When you reread Casey, there is this very striking language, and I think that's why, Roe and Casey were often referred to as super precedent by senators during confirmation hearings and other politicians, because I don't have the language memorized, but I think the justices in Casey wrote that, they were upholding Roe as a promise of constancy, and that the overruling of Roe would be, I think, a breach of faith is what they said. So that's very strong language about precedent. And you could see, since Casey was not widely cited on stare decisis issues. It was cited in a few cases, but if you look at the cases that had overruled prior cases in the last few years, and there have been a number of them, I think Justice Kavanaugh pointed that out in his Dobbs opinion, that every sitting member of the court had voted to overrule a prior precedent. You do see that Casey went missing from certain opinions. And I think where we saw the long game really come out, and it was in Justice Gorsuch's opinion in Ramos, where it seemed to be a fairly simple case. There were only two states in this entire country that allowed non-unanimous jury verdicts. I think Justice Gorsuch made it a more complicated case than it had to be. There was a portion of the opinion that argued that the prior precedent wasn't precedent at all. But you could see the groundwork both in Justice Gorsuch's main opinion, where he's going through various factors that would authorize or legitimize the Supreme Court from overruling a prior case, but you also see it in Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, which I think really laid the groundwork for Dobbs in sort of two critical respects. One, is this idea of egregious error that Dobbs uses as a factor. I think Justice Kavanaugh called it grievous error, but I think it's roughly the same. The other issue that came out in Ramos that is very interesting in light of Dobbs is this discussion about reliance interests, right? And that I think, you know, for me, public defender, avowed liberal and progressive, you know, that was the hardest part of Justice Alito's opinion to digest for me. One, the decision that the court is not to look at intangible reliance interests, and again, in my humble opinion, sort of the short shrifting of the concrete reliance interests. But I do want to focus on the intangible reliance issues, because that's what I find most interesting about putting Ramos and Dobbs together. Because Justice Gorsuch, in very, very strong language, at the end of his opinion, chides the liberal justices, I think Justice Kagan, for not fully accounting for the interests of the American people in having criminal juries render unanimous verdicts. Now, I have to tell you, I've had about 60 federal jury trials. I've probably watched 100 more. I've seen that many voir dires. I've seen lawyers and judges in nearly every case ask potential jury members about what they think about the rule that a jury has to be unanimous. And I have to tell you, I think their eyes are glazing over, probably like your eyes are glazing over now, listening to me to speak. And so to me, although I love Justice Gorsuch's language, it was, you know, sort of very simple and very powerful language, it totally runs counter to my experience. But it's clearly what he was saying was, in the terms of overruling a prior Supreme Court case, that intangible interests do matter, that Americans have this reliance interest in what he called the preservation of our liberties. So you fast forward a few years to Dobbs, and Justice Gorsuch, of course, joins the majority opinion, and Justice Alito basically says, no, intangible reliance interests don't count at all. The court, he you know, cites a number of reasons, and again, and I'm not saying he was being disingenuous, but because I think there are they are legitimate topics to discuss. I think he got it wrong. You know, one, he said that the court is not equipped to, you know, assess whether Americans or individuals have these intangible reliant interests, even though Justice Gorsuch said only a few years earlier that they did. So that's. You know, very, very interesting to me to sort of compare those opinions on that point. And then what I'm, you know, obviously very interested in is what we're looking at going forward in terms of criminal procedure. Because one of the things that does concern me as a public defender and as an American, you know, are the rights of criminal procedure that my clients currently possess, most of them given to them by the Warren Court. And there, you know, there is a part of the opinion that can be read in what Justice Kavanaugh was saying, and Justice Alito points this out in Ramos, whether any decision that is not grounded in originalism, I don't often use that word, as you can probably tell. I do use outcome. Is egregiously wrong, right? And so to me, that is very concerning, because if you look at the Warren Court's decisions, you do see the argument that some could make that they are functionalist opinions. And I'll give you two examples. One that scares me for both, you know, me and my clients, one that scares me, Mapp versus Ohio. you know, that's the case that where the Warren Court said that the remedy for police misconduct is the suppression of evidence. I would imagine how many originalists are here today? Would any say that that remedy is grounded in the text or history or tradition of the United States? A much smaller show of hands. So I think under the conception of Dobbs, you know, that type of opinion can be viewed as egregiously wrong. So I think, you know, that is something I'm concerned about. Now, the other side to that is like the Bruton case that came out last year, Somaya. The Supreme Court has essentially already overruled Mapp versus Ohio because, you know, suppression law is riddled with so many exceptions. It's not very much of an issue now. But what I am most concerned about for myself, because I do have a mortgage to pay, I have kids to put through college, is, you know, what Justices Gorsuch and Thomas have written about, that Gideon versus Wainwright was wrongly decided. And of course, that is a classic functionalist opinion. You know, how many would say that the right for state and federal taxpayers to provide lawyers for people accused of crime is found in the text, tradition, or history of the Constitution? Oh, good. You should all be judges, and then I'll still have a job. But no, they are on record saying that case was wrongly decided. And, you know, sort of the bottom line is, and I've talked for way too long, and I apologize, but we'll see where this goes. But definitely there are many, many criminal procedure opinions that help my clients that may be put at risk because of Dobbs.
So, like Michael, I want to start with Ramis as sort of a starting point for how and why we might be here. As Michael said, in Ramis, the court found that under the Sixth Amendment, the criminal jury verdicts have to be unanimous. In doing so, the court overturned the Apodaca case, where the court nearly 50 years earlier had found that 10-2 and 11-1 verdicts were constitutionally sufficient. So in Apodaca, the court had applied this cost-benefit analysis, this functional approach that Michael was talking about, in determining the constitutional requirements, and looked at whether the jury could effectively serve its function with non-unanimous verdicts. The fact that unanimous verdicts were used at the time of the founding was considered not to be important enough. It was insufficient for constitutionally requiring the unanimous verdict. And then in contrast, the Ramis case looked at the practice at the time of the founding, taking a historical approach or some sort of originalist approach to discerning those constitutional requirements under the Sixth Amendment. So, of course, this was a really marked change, moving from that functional approach to the originalist or historical one. And it was significant, too, that the court in doing this overturned, again, nearly 50 years of precedent in this arena. And as Michael was talking about in concurrence, Justice Kavanaugh really digs into the requirements or ideas about when stare decisis ought to be followed and when it ought to be put aside. And so we see the court, I think, in Dobbs picking up somewhat on that concurrence that Kavanaugh has in the Ramis case. And the court in Dobbs focused, again, on the strength of the grounds in which the prior decision was adopted. Of course, there are other factors, but that seemed to be the most significant one in Dobbs. But it seems that the court, by strength of its grounds, and Michael alluded to this, it seems more like the strength of the mode of constitutional interpretation. And as we all know, the court has become more conservative in recent years, and many say it's become more originalist in its methodology, although I think there's quite a bit of fuzziness about what type of originalism is being applied, whether it's consistently being applied, whether it truly is originalism. Some say it's a fig leaf for political preferences, et cetera. And as the court indicated in the Dobbs case, it's ready to, I think, write earlier decisions about constitutional interpretation that were perhaps wrongly decided during the Warren Court, especially, where we have a lot of movement in criminal procedure, and just in other previous cases. And the court's really ready, I think, to have major upheaval and precedent in, if it's necessary to get there to these originalist right decisions. Okay, so the Warren Court, which changed a lot of criminal procedure, a lot of those decisions, most of those decisions were not grounded in originalism or historical analysis, or at least not only grounded in originalism or historical analysis, and took more of a patchwork of methods of constitutional interpretation in reaching those decisions. So this court's favorable view of originalism or historical analysis of some sort, paired with its willingness that we see in Dobbs to disregard stare decisis, I think really sets the stage for some significant upheaval in criminal procedure like we're talking about. But perhaps the biggest change, at least in terms of doctrinal change, maybe not necessarily in terms of effects on the ground, but the biggest change in terms of doctrinal change, I think, really is in the context of the Eighth Amendment. Since the 1958 case of Trop v. Dulles, the court has pretty consistently applied the evolving standards of decency approach in Eighth Amendment cases, trying to assess the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. So this approach, what we see in the Eighth Amendment, is probably the most antithetical to traditional views of originalism, to a historical approach, focusing on practices and morals that are changing over time rather than on the beliefs and perhaps practices, depending upon what sort of originalism you apply at the time of the founding. So putting this evolving standards of decency approach to the side and replacing it with one focused on practices at the time of the founding, for example, really can make some major changes in Eighth Amendment doctrine. So we might see the court setting aside prohibitions, for example, on executing juveniles under the Eighth Amendment, or executing intellectually disabled persons, or limits on grossly excessive punishment. We even see Governor DeSantis has recently signed a bill providing for a death penalty in child rape cases, something that under a 2008 case by the court, Kennedy v. Louisiana, is unconstitutional, but we see perhaps DeSantis seeing the court maybe setting aside that precedent. It would also suggest that at least constitutionally, capital punishment is here to stay, even if a supermajority of jurisdictions find it morally repugnant. The court has already pretty explicitly said that this is going to be the case because, for various reasons, capital punishment is here to stay, at least as a constitutional matter. Focusing on practices at the time of the founding also would suggest that practices such as ear cropping, splitting noses, branding foreheads could potentially, at least constitutionally, be legitimate. Whether states actually put those practices, things into practice is a different question. So I think in the Eighth Amendment, again, at least doctrinally, we might see some major changes as a result of this confluence of the focus on originalism and the willingness to set aside precedent. Well, perhaps the biggest changes or the biggest implications of the court's favoritism of originalism or historical approach and movement away from stare decisis is probably in the Eighth Amendment context, because this evolving standards of decency approach is so antithetical to historical analysis. The effects, I think, throughout criminal procedure could potentially be enormous. So, for example, the court's decision in Ramis suggests that perhaps in a similar context, there have to be 12 people on juries in criminal matters, something that's long been written off as just a historical accident, just as unanimous verdicts were before Ramis. Justice Gorsuch actually recently talked about this in his dissent in a denial of cert. So I think that might be coming down the pipe potentially. And the limitations that the court has put on the interpretation of Justice Scalia's Crawford opinion. Right now, it's sort of been narrowed to some extent. Those could perhaps fade away, and we have a more robust analysis under Crawford, something that we might already be seeing a bit in the works. In my view, some of these outcomes could be positive. Some of them could be negative. I think criminal procedure is unique compared to other areas of constitutional law in that you might have, as John alluded to, you might have liberals agreeing with outcomes that are in line with originalist methodology, which I think is pretty rare compared to some other areas of constitutional law. And if we take a historical analysis to things, and if it's consistently done, perhaps an originalist approach could have the result of making criminal procedure, which is really quite fractured in many ways, making it more coherent. But again, I think that's dependent upon a certain type of originalism being applied consistently, which I think is unlikely to happen, perhaps. So in that case, we might actually see more fracturing in criminal procedure. Only time will tell, of course, what version of originalism a majority of the court is going to apply, whether it does it consistently, whether it maintains its moxie in significantly transforming the criminal procedure landscape. I really look forward, to some extent with a bit of trepidation, as to what the court is going to do down the line, but I also look forward to hearing what all of your thoughts are on the matter. Thank you.
All right, thanks so much. It's tough going last at the end of the afternoon, so please excuse me if I fall asleep during my own talk. So I'll try to be as brief as I can. My understanding of what we were talking about today is that we're thinking about the ways in which Dobbs, and particularly its treatment of stare decisis, may impact criminal law, criminal procedure going forward. And as I thought about the stare decisis factors in Dobbs, I thought in particular about this notion of grievous error, right? That if there's a grievous error, we can overturn a precedent. And in thinking about grievous error in Dobbs, you know, Dobbs actually has been criticized as being a non-originalist opinion. I don't know if you've heard this, but if you look at what Dobbs says about Roe and Casey, it says, well, there's no text about a right to abortion, and a right to abortion is not deeply rooted in this country's history and tradition. And in determining whether it should be considered deeply rooted, the court takes the Glucksberg approach, which is to say sort of a concrete approach to history and tradition, and says, is there any concrete right to abortion historically? The answer is no. Now, folks on the left might say that that's a non-originalist opinion for two reasons. One is there's no effort to establish that the deeply rooted standard itself is part of the original meaning of the Constitution. And secondly, there's no effort to show that the Glucksberg approach to deep rootedness, that is the concrete approach, is the correct originalist approach to determining unenumerated rights, because there's also the sort of the Casey, Lawrence, Obergefell approach to deeply rooted, which is the abstract approach. Is there an abstract right to liberty and equality, et cetera, in our country's history and tradition? And if there is such an abstract right, then can we identify abortion as being consistent with that abstract right? So we have these, and you know, in the case law, and I think this is an extremely important issue for constitutional interpretation, we have both the Glucksberg approach and the Casey, Lawrence, Obergefell approach. None of these cases have been overturned. They're both sort of available as approaches to constitutional interpretation. And what I'm going to argue today actually is that the court, although it didn't attempt to do so, it actually did get the original meaning right in using the Glucksberg approach. And the reason it did so will actually have a deep effect on future precedents in the area of criminal law, criminal procedure in particular. Now, again, this is a complex issue, and I've only got a few minutes, so I'll try and go through it quickly, and I can take things sort of in questions if people have them. I want to start actually with Justice Scalia, who in many ways is a great hero to originalism, but also in some ways made some mistakes that I think that have cost us. And the one that's really at issue here is his idea of what the common law is. Justice Scalia, like many folks in the post-realist era, had two sort of diametrically opposed ideas of what the common law is in his head at the same time. One of those ideas was that the common law is judges making policy from the bench as they go based on their own preferences. The other is that the common law is a set of rules that were established way back in the day and that are unchangeable and that we can refer to as sort of this historical grounding, right? They're both there in his thought. They're both there in all of our thought, I think, on some level. But actually, I think they're incorrect. They're not a correct understanding of what the common law is. And I really lay the fault here with Oliver Wendell Holmes, who they say he's a great hero of the law. I think he's one of the great villains, truthfully. Because he's the one who came up with this idea that the common law is judges making policy and it should be judges making policy. Prior to Holmes, nobody asserted that judges had a lawmaking power under the common law. Critics of the common law said that's what judges are really doing, but the common law was never justified on this basis. Rather, it was justified on the basis of custom and long usage. That is, the common law was a kind of customary law, and judges would identify customs that had been established through time immemorial, long-standing customs, and then apply those customs to new situations. And a custom could only count as law if it was universally received throughout the jurisdiction for a very, very long period of time. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, most of the rights we're talking about when we talk about criminal procedure, rights under the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Eighth Amendment, were originally common law rights. They existed at common law. They were then enumerated in the Bill of Rights. And so when we think about what those rights are and what they mean and how they apply, it's important that we understand what the common law is and how those rights came to develop, because they are common law rights. Also, a second, and this relates to unenumerated rights. Let me back up for a second. Common law thinkers, one of the questions that they often faced was, how could the common law be law when Parliament has never said thou shalt or thou shalt not? The king, the president, Congress, no one has said thou shalt or thou shalt not. It's just judges deciding cases. How can that be law? And the answer to that was that the customs of a free people are more reliable in determining what's just and fair and reasonable than the judgment of any one moment in time or any one branch of government, right? So we look to long-standing customs. If something has been universally received throughout the generations, then this is powerful evidence that it's reasonable, which is to say it comports with principles of reason or natural justice, and that it enjoys the consent of the people. Because if it didn't have those two qualities, it would fall out of usage. Unlike a statute, there's nothing holding it in place except for continued usage, right? Why is that important? That idea, I mean, ultimately, common law thinkers came to the conclusion that the common law was better than positive law at comporting with natural principles of justice. That when you had a new statute, it was more likely to be unreasonable or unjust than the common law rule that it replaced, right? And this is why we have rules of interpretation like statutes and derogation of the common law shall be narrowly construed, because the notion was the legislature was likely to mess it up relative to the common law, okay? Now, this gave rise to the idea of rights enforceable against the sovereign. Because in England, and then especially in America at the time of the Revolution, there was this idea that there's some rights established at common law that are so fundamental that even the king and parliament can't change them, right? The right to a jury trial, the right not to be taxed without representation in parliament, et cetera. These were not established by positive law. They were common law rights, but they enjoyed long usage. They were considered fundamental to existence as a free people, so fundamental that this is, even these, the government can't do anything about, all right? And then ultimately, of course, we encode them in the Bill of Rights because we want to make sure that the Congress won't do what Parliament did and try to deny that they're actually fundamental. This, I think, helps us think about unenumerated rights. If there are unenumerated rights, and I'm not sure there are, but if there are unenumerated rights, how do we identify them? Well, the common law would say you identify them by looking to see whether they've been established through long usage. Have they been universally recognized throughout the jurisdiction for a very long period of time? That is to say, the Glucksberg approach. I think without even knowing it, the Glucksberg approach actually is the correct approach for identifying fundamental rights, unenumerated rights, that is, if they do exist. Also, it's the correct way of thinking through the sort of the meaning and scope of enumerated rights, right? We look at how the rights developed at common law. And by the way, we say developed, but in fact, the tradition's not a dead tradition. Edward Coke, the greatest common law thinker, wrote, "Custom loses its being if usage fails." Right? So if something was thought to be just and reasonable, but then fell out of usage for a very long period of time, then that's powerful evidence that it's actually not just and reasonable because it did not withstand the test of time. So for example, slitting nostrils and cutting off ears fell out of usage centuries ago. If we tried to bring them back, they're no longer part of the tradition. And by the way, the words cruel and unusual, the word unusual means contrary to long usage. Unjustly harsh in light of longstanding prior practice. So this is our method of determining whether a given practice comports with fundamental rights that came through the common law, is to determine whether they meet with our historical practices. Okay, now, in the Eighth Amendment context, this is where I spend most of my career writing and thinking about the Eighth Amendment. I think that there are lots of things one might say about the possible consequences. I'm not going to go into them in detail. I'll just give a little list. People can ask me questions if they want. Yes, the death penalty itself is probably safe, but instances of the death penalty that fell out of usage centuries ago, like, for example, the first Congress authorized the death penalty for counterfeiting, probably not okay, right, because it hasn't been done for two centuries. Lethal injection, I think probably not okay, because the three-drug protocol involves a risk of severe suffering prior to death that's much greater than traditional methods like hanging. Long-term solitary confinement, probably not okay, because again, it imposes extreme suffering in comparison to imprisonment. So there's a mixed bag in terms of the outcomes if you were to do original meaning, although I would argue that overall, the Eighth Amendment becomes much more protective of criminal offenders under the original meaning than it does under the evolving standards of decency test. I won't go into any more detail, just to list a few things. Obviously, the Fourth Amendment, we've seen a move in this direction as well. There was a mention of the Kylo case, but also, Carpenter versus U.S., Riley versus California. These are cases where the court is struggling to think about technology in the context of searches and seizures, but also in terms of the language of the Constitution, persons, houses, papers, and effects. How do we think of technological surveillance in those terms? And I think the way the court is doing it is potentially very productive and very protective of criminal rights. Fifth Amendment, I just got to give a shout out to Miranda and Dickerson. Dickerson might be the most unjustifiable decision that's still surviving, I think, in the court. It's hard to see how Miranda continues to survive going forward, except that, in effect, it's now kind of a pro-law enforcement decision. Because as long as you follow Miranda, no one's going to win on a claim that you've coerced an interrogation out of somebody. So law enforcement no longer has any interest in getting it overturned. Talked about the Eighth Amendment. A couple of other things. The right to habeas corpus. I mean, one open question, and I don't know the answer to this, is the AEDPA too narrow in light of the historical meaning of the right to habeas corpus? Has it made it unavailable in ways that it would have been available at common law? And if so, is that constitutional? And one final point for criminal law, and I want to, especially for the judges in the room, think about reviving the rule of strict construction of penal statutes. This was a rule that survived in this country until the middle of the 20th century when Justice Frankfurter replaced it with the rule of lenity. The rule of lenity is a weak, sickly cousin, barely related to the rule of strict construction of penal statutes. The basis of the rule of strict construction is that when you have a new penal statute that's significantly harsher than what the common law would permit, then we have to be very skeptical about it, and we're going to read it as narrowly as we reasonably can. That rule is no longer in effect. The rule of lenity is like a piece of shrapnel floating in the atmosphere. Sometimes it lands somewhere, but it doesn't do much. So judges, read the first edition of Sutherland's on statutory construction. Don't read today's, it's mishmash. And you will do much to protect criminal defendants. Thanks so much.
Okay, so we don't have a ton of time because I have to have everyone out of here by 5 sharp. And I'd ask that you immediately, I know you want to talk to your neighbor afterwards or talk to the panelists. I ask that you do it in the hall because the FedSoc folks have to shut this down. And because the Scalia dinner is tonight, reminder, there's buses, and they start at 5:15 and end at 6:30. And so now I'm going to turn it to the panelists, but because we went over, I'm going to, yes, That's a shot at the four of you, FYI. I am going to limit your time and cut you off. You each get 2 minutes because I want to make sure that the audience can ask questions. So, Professor Bash, or Attorney Bash, Mr. Esquire, do you want to say anything? You get 2 minutes.
I'll just ask John a question so that he can use the time. The true originalist Eighth Amendment, I mean, I guess I've been under the assumption that the original meaning of the Eighth Amendment related only to methods of punishment, not to the things that have been it's been expanded to, but you mentioned counterfeiting, not being able to have the death penalty for counterfeiting, which is not a method of punishment issue, but a fit between the crime and the punishment. Does your research show that at common law that would have been understood to be encompassed by that concept?
Yeah, so first of all, let me say, if you're interested in this particular topic or if you have trouble sleeping, I wrote an article called Rethinking Proportionality Under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. It's in the Virginia Law Review, and it lays out my thesis in detail. I'll give you one quick kind of fun story to highlight this. So the phrase cruel and unusual punishments first showed up in the English Bill of Rights in the 17th century. And we know very well what it means because of a fellow named Titus Oates. Now, Titus Oates was this disreputable Anglican clergyman who had trouble with the law. He'd fallen out of favor. He had no job. And he was sort of like a 17th century Kardashian. He really wanted fame and fortune. And he thought, what will get me fame and fortune? Well, everyone hates Catholics, and everyone's worried that the Spanish Armada is going to come sailing up the Thames any day now. So if I make up a story that there's a popish plot to kill the king, then everyone will love me, right? And so he does. He tells this story to a magistrate. He names 15 people, including the queen's physician, as conspirators. He gives this evidence to a magistrate. The magistrate then turns up dead in the streets of London, right? So now it's Panic at the Disco. And they have these trials, and there's a series of trials of the conspirators, and it's like, you know, trial, conviction, execution, trial, conviction, execution. Finally, at like the 15th trial, it comes out that the whole story was made up. And there was this key meeting of the conspirators that had supposedly happened in England, and it was proven that Oates was actually in France enjoying some wine and cheese on the day of the supposed meeting of the conspirators. And so now everyone was like, what do we do with Oates, right? Because we just killed all these innocent people because of him. He's sort of like a serial killer, morally speaking, but the only crime that he committed was perjury, which was not a felony, and therefore you couldn't take his life for perjury. And so they gave him, Chief Justice Jeffreys, the famous hanging judge, said, you know, we have something special prepared for you. And then another justice sort of gave the punishment, which was a big fine. He was going to be whipped and then being dragged from Aldgate to Newgate, so across the city of London. Then 2 days later, dragged from Newgate to Tyburn while being whipped again. Imprisoned for life, he was defrocked, and put in the pillory 4 times a year for life. Okay, so this was his punishment. 5 years later, new king, English Bill of Rights is now in place, and he shows up in Parliament and says, hey, what was done to me was cruel and unusual. Can you please lift the judgment? And if you read the parliamentary debates, they make it very clear that they agree that it was cruel and unusual. In fact, the House of Commons delegates say they were thinking of Oates specifically when they wrote the cruel and unusual punishments clause. The House of Lords, though, wouldn't lift the judgment because he was such a bad guy. They say he's so ill a man, shouldn't get the benefit. And so
this is it, one sentence.
It's only cruel and unusual because it's disproportionate to the crime of perjury.
Good, you kept it to once. Okay, Mr. Caruso, you get 2 minutes.
Hey, I'll ask John a question as well. You know, because I hope you're going to try to dampen some of my pessimism about this subject. So, you know, I'm very interested in this, you know, custom and usage, true originalism, you know, doctrine, because when I look at, you know, Gideon, when I look at Miranda, and when I look at Mapp, those are very, very old cases. So in talking about custom and usage, what counts, you know, the last 65 years or the preceding 150 years? And, you know, now that I would say that all three of those cases have been accepted and embraced by the American people. So how does that fit into that doctrine?
Well, I would say initially a judge can't create a custom, right? And so when a judge issues an opinion, especially a justice of the Supreme Court, that incorrectly interprets the Constitution and then freezes that situation in place, the mere fact that it remains frozen in place over a period of time shouldn't count, right? Because the notion is it's the customs of the people, right? The customs arising from the people that remain in place only because we choose to continue using them.
How did that work in normal common law stuff? I mean, like, consequential damages are not available for breach of contract. How could the custom of the people, apart from judicial decisions, develop that principle?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the thing about the way the common law thinkers think about this custom is that it is judges who are identifying the custom and applying the custom, and they're not ever trying to find some moment in time when the people absent the judiciary had a custom and then the judges adopted it, right? So it is that judges have used this from time immemorial. We can't find a time when they haven't used it. It's continued in usage. But the key thing here is that there are many opportunities for it to stop being used. And so any given custom, I shouldn't say any given, but many customs could stop being used because a judge refuses to apply the rule anymore, because a prosecutor ceases to apply the rule, because a jury won't convict in a certain situation or won't apply a certain penalty when that's in their power. It's not the Supreme Court with sort of a single top-down approach that can never be displaced.
Can I reclaim some of my time because John stole it?
No, I think the professor used it when you gave it, but yes, right. You can have a minute.
So I want to add
no response.
Okay, and so this is all very interesting to me because, you know, this use in customs, because in the Ramos case that we were talking about earlier, you know, the Sixth Amendment says an impartial jury, right? Many of these constitutional constitutional norms are not self-executing. They're very vague language, but yet Justice Gorsuch was able to tease out that impartiality provision also encompassed unanimity. So I'm wondering how all that plays in, but you're not allowed to answer, so I'll just think about this for myself.
Yeah. No, you can answer. You get 1 minute, though, and I'm serious.
You need the yellow.
The answer is,
red.
I don't know.
Okay. That's good. Fair. You stayed
That's
within
fair.
The minute. All right, Professor Ryan, so I'm going to ask you a question instead of you letting ask Professor Stinford a question, which is, I saw you, as he was talking, thinking, now this sounds like an originalism I can endorse. Could you or no? And if not, why not?
Yes, to some extent. I'm sympathetic towards John Stinford's view of original interpretation of the Eighth Amendment. My concern is that I don't think it's the same type of originalism that the current Supreme Court is applying. And I think, as I said, time will tell, I think, exactly what the Supreme Court is going to do in terms of their originalism. But it seems like a more draconian version to me, and not as evolving as John's version.
Okay, do you want to say anything else? Because you were well within your time. All right, questions from the audience. Go to the mics. They're behind you. Yes, sir.
Kai Alberg from Washington State. I saw the Miranda and Mapp cases mentioned, and I think you can probably put Escobedo in the same category. I'd like you to look in your crystal balls. Do you think the Supreme Court actually going there and looking at if those cases were grievously wrong and possibly overruling any of them? Or will it just be left at academia saying, well, in theory, this case could be under attack if you follow the line of Dobbs?
I do not think those cases are going to be reconsidered. I mean, as somebody said, MAP has just been carved away through other means, so there's no point in using essentially capital, stare decisis capital, on overruling the exclusionary rule. What's the other one you said? Miranda, for the reason said, the law enforcement likes Miranda now. You say something that someone who's very stressed and has been arrested is barely listening to and just sounds like something they heard on TV, and then like it immunizes a whole range of conduct. So I just don't think there's any movement to overrule those at all.
Yeah, and in Dickerson, the law enforcement weighed in on the side of Miranda because they liked certainty.
The police have incorporated that into their practice. 99% of all people who are questioned waive their Miranda rights. I would just briefly say Gideon does cause me concern, because when you look at like a state of Georgia, which has a horrifically inefficient state public defender system that drains their state taxpayer resources, I do wonder if there'll be an enterprising state solicitor general who does bring that issue before the court.
Just a gut reaction, but I just do not think Justice Kavanaugh, who's at least for now, his vote or Chief Justice Roberts' vote would be required for overruling anything. I don't see them overruling Gideon versus Wainwright.
Thank you.
I don't know. I've never talked about that, but I just don't see that happening.
Over here.
Thank you. My name is Mike Isaac. I'm from Tampa, Florida. And like Mr. Caruso, I may be the only criminal defense attorney in the room, but I'm actually an originalist in
Texas. I defend criminal defense. Just people who pay for it, but I...
Yeah. John just wants big money work.
He does it the right way.
Mike does it because he has his heart in it, and John does it for the money. No, I'm kidding.
That's exactly right. Oh, no apologies necessary.
So I'm not sure that I share your concern about the future of where the decisions are going in light of Dobbs. How do you reconcile that concern with, for example, Justice Alito's concurrence and Coniglio versus Strom? Of course, I'm talking about the community caretaking doctrine that came from Katie versus Dombrowski in 1973. So that's 50 years of precedent, and yet in the concurrence, Justice Alito makes it very clear that this was a passing statement in the case. It was never intended to be used as a freestanding exception to the Fourth Amendment. And for those criminal defense attorneys in the room, we know that prosecutors like to use community caretaking in circumstances where police don't have a warrant, they don't have reasonable suspicion. So it seems to me that the originalistic point of view that Justice Alito gave was quite helpful to the criminal defense bar.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure that Justice Alito has ever on purpose been helpful to the criminal defense bar. You know, I think he did write Flores Figueroa, so that was one helpful case. But I don't know. But, you know, ultimately, I agree with John in that, you know, there are only, you know, I think two justices, maybe three, who are really looking to undo past cases. You know, those are Justices Alito and Thomas, and to a certain extent Judge Gorsuch, depending on the issue. He's a self-proclaimed libertarian, right? So you never know what a libertarian is going to do. I mean, he's, he wrote McGirt, which is, you know, created as criminal defense lawyers. I have to tell you, I embrace chaos because it's really the only one advantage I have in the courtroom, and McGirt was clearly has wreaked chaos across the
state. A lot of Oklahoma is a reservation, and so many of the federal convictions or state convictions were out.
Right. Yeah. So, but I don't know. You know, I'm not going to sleep well at night thinking that Justice Alito is going to help my clients down the line.
The most characteristic Justice Thomas thing ever is he had one opinion where he said, it's high time this court reconsider Calder versus Bull, 1798.
That's going back.
Yeah.
Hi, Devin Watkins. William Penn, in kind of colonial America, thought that bail rights were required under Magna Carta for anyone that was not a capital offense where the proof was clear. So I'm wondering, do you think there's a possibility of a revival of more stringent requirements for bail for, preventing any kind of bail for non-capital crimes or bail that's beyond what someone can reasonably give to get pretrial release?
I mean, since the constitutional law is not terribly robust in the area of bail, I do think that's an area that's ripe for some building upon, and perhaps not so much limits. I guess I wouldn't expect so much limits on bail as I would expect it to become a little more of an important right, I guess, under this current court.
Yeah, I would hope that to be true. You know, talking about custom and usage, you know, if you look at the cases, you know, from district to district, the decisions of magistrate judges, mostly some district court judges regarding bail, really are not tethered to the Bail Reform Act at all, which is the leading statute on the case, and is really based on what the tradition is in your district about who gets bail or not. So that's, you know, I think that I agree that is a sort of ripe area.
I just can't remember. Has the bail clause been incorporated? That I don't know.
I think so.
Yep.
It has, okay. So
mm-hmm.
It could come up that way. Maybe.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Lawson, work at Cato currently. This is not to any one of you in particular, but What do you think about bringing back some level of jury nullification? I know it pretty much entirely went away very early in the 19th century, but it was pretty huge and pretty important and influential in the 1700s. Some pretty key cases, including truth being defense, libel and stuff like that, which isn't exactly criminal law, but my point. But we're very influential in America, in particular, not just England, and they were jury not listening to the legal advice of the legal doctrine said by the judge of the case.
What does bringing it back look? What does bringing it back look like? I mean, the jury can do that now. Now, the defense counsel probably would not be permitted to argue to the jury that you should nullify. Is that what you mean? Because the jury right now could say, screw this, we're
acquitting
you.
Well, I'm pretty sure that that was the exact argument in that libel case, was that the law is against me, but you should nullify it because it's unjust against natural law of reason and justice.
Right, John's right. I mean, juries do nullify, but defense lawyers are prohibited from arguing that. You know, one issue that has been litigated through the federal courts is whether defense lawyers or the judge could let the jury know what punishment the defendant is facing. I know District Court Judge Weinstein had written a very lengthy order on that I don't think has been adopted by any other court. So I think, to me, that's an interesting issue, because if you talk to jurors after trial, after they've convicted, and let them know what the client is facing, you often see some amount of remorse.
Michael, would you be in favor of lawyers being able to argue for nullification?
You know, I would. You know, I would. One, my resume would look a lot better if I could make that argument.
Do you worry? Can I ask another question? Do you worry? Do you worry that if you argue for nullification, in some sense, you admit the guilt, and so there would be cases that are tough for a prosecutor to prove that you might lose as a result?
So I think that's why, you know, public defenders and private criminal defense lawyers should be trained. You know, we often do, you probably see these in court opinions, argue in the alternative. Sometimes you can't do it directly for fear of confusing the jury about the theory of your case, but I've argued in the alternative, you know, trying to sow the seeds of what a jury, you know, may say back in the deliberation room, you know, because I do subscribe to the theory that in closing argument, what a lawyer should do is arm the jurors who are most likely to vote not guilty with the ammunition they need to convince other jurors. So I think the more that's available to a criminal defense lawyer to do that, the better, you know, whether it's clear, you know, whether that's grounded in the text, history, and constitution of our country is another issue, but I would.
In this hypothetical world, can the prosecutor say what he did is not a crime, but it should be? Maybe I'll go for that.
Or, you know, the flip side of that is Rule 404B, which is, you know, the love of prosecutors and the bane of criminal defense lawyers. You know, would prosecutors be like, oh, let me tell you about all this stuff that he was convicted about, you know, in other cases, so.
Over here.
Yeah, I'm Lawson the Elder, Boston University School of Law. Professor Stiniford mentioned revival of the rule of strict construction. I wonder what the panel thinks about this. It's a constitutional rule that all facts in criminal cases have to be proved by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt. Why isn't it a constitutional rule that the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the law means what the prosecution says it means?
And just for those of you really interested in this, the good professor has written a book on it, as well as a great law review.
Well, I'm just pulling up my Sixth Amendment, sorry. Let's see.
Do you want to go ahead, Professor Stiniford, while he's looking?
Yeah, I mean, I can say, I don't know the answer to that, though. I look forward to reading your book. I will say it does seem to relate to that earlier question about the powers of the jury, right? Because I think what my limited understanding was that the jury had power over both law and fact, right? That was the jury could decide in some ultimate sense what the law was in a way that it can't now. And I don't know the details of that or how it changed, but I think that's something that is worth thinking about, whether there's some constitutional aspect to that.
So I'm going to speak for the professor because I've read his stuff, and I think it's brilliant for those of you out there. But and ask this, and Professor, if I'm wrong, you can correct me, but I think what he's thinking is we often, when we interpret laws, meaning judges, interpret them by kind of a preponderance of the evidence standard. If you look at a lot of cases, the carrying a firearm, all that, the use of a firearm, we're trying to figure it out. And what he's saying is, why isn't the burden on the government to, and it kind of gets to your strict construction point, but it's rooted in a way that you can, judges are good of thinking of burdens. Strict construction's harder for us. You know, Justice Scalia always said reasonable construction's a better term than strict. And as you know, Justice Barrett said, the rule of lenity is a substantive canon, which we should revisit whether we apply substantive canon. So I guess my point, and I think the professor's, is why not use the similar rules of evidence to interpret laws when that is more, as Professor Lawson has argued, baked into the Constitution and kind of the role of a judge.
So, but would it be the jury or the judge under that view?
The judge.
The judge would still do it. Interesting. Well, I mean, the judges do use clear and convincing for legal things sometimes, and I guess you could do that, invalidity of a patent and stuff like that.
Right, but what he's saying is use the same standard. It's reasonable, that beyond a reasonable doubt. So it would, in effect, be strict construction because the burden is on the government to prove that the law encompasses this conduct.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think the key, I mean, whatever terminology you use, the key is for judges to understand the reason behind the rule. So if you look at, again, early sort of judicial manuals, they would say things like, why do we do strict construction? Because the law loves life and the law loves liberty and the law hates punishment. Like, and therefore, it's the duty of the judge to construe this as narrowly as the judge reasonably can. Like, not unnaturally reasonably, but as narrowly as they can, because there's a substantive preference against punishment. So again, whether you phrase that in terms of burden of proof or strict construction, I think the core is that the judge knows why they're doing it. And if they know why they're doing it, I think we'll get good results.
Interesting. Yeah. So I'll tell my own law review in the Yale Law Journal, which talks about that in relation to federal laws, when you're interpreting them against someone, you have an obligation to apply a deference to liberty. And that's the point you're making. And I trace it back to the founding and the judicial power itself. Over here.
My name's not Lawson, and I did not write a book about my question. I did write a law review about it, though. So one of the things I say there, but more importantly, that Gorsuch and Scalia have said, is that non-retroactivity fits very uncomfortably with originalism's fixation thesis. And Justice Gorsuch in his Edwards concurrence says, that's okay, it's kind of an equilibrium adjustment. But my question is it an equilibrium adjustment that makes any sense in light of the supposed problem of overusing habeas to then undermine the originalist project with opinions like Bochting that say, actually, a rule being originalist means it's new, not means it's old?
I don't think I understand the question.
I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, Professor Bode has written about qualified immunity, that it's, you know, Scalia's wrong about it because it's an equilibrium adjustment to compensate for Monroe versus Pape, but it's one that's poorly tailored. Is Teague and Edwards the same sort of poorly tailored equilibrium adjustment?
Halfway originalism, I think he says.
Yeah, I mean, was Teague an interpretation of the constitutional habeas right or some statute? Statutory habeas.
At the time, it was neither, but in Danforth, they classified it as an interpretation of 2243.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess I don't know if it's a proper originalist interpretation of 2243.
But it adopts an interpretation of Supreme Court opinions as creating new law, is my point.
I see
what you're
saying.
Scalia's point and Gorsuch's point.
Sounds like a professor question.
Yeah, I agree.
This does not sound like a PD question.
This is not an answer to that question exactly, but I think the more you move away from the foundations of whatever your view of originalism are, the less legitimacy it has. And I think, as I suggested before, if the Supreme Court is adjusting things to account for other things, and not just applying originalism and its view of what originalism actually is or how it ought to be applied, then it loses some of its credibility and you end up with more fractured criminal procedure, yes.
Sir?
My name is Jacob Smith. My question is, Do any of the panelists have opinions on whether harmless error and plain error are consistent with the original meaning of the Constitution?
Don't the federal rules require
yes.
harmless error and plain error? So it doesn't matter. I mean, Congress can establish rules for, right?
I guess they can't what he's saying is they can't establish rules inconsistent with the meaning of the Constitution. And so could they be unconstitutional?
Oh, I see. That your conviction must be vacated
so
if some error.
I'll add to his, I'm sorry, I'm going to add to your question. Is Nieder wrongly decided?
Is Nieder harmless error if you omit an element of the offense?
Yes.
The jury instruction.
Yeah.
The jury instruction case.
Well, I say yes on that because Scalia didn't, that's what I'm remembering. But
Scalia's opinion's great in that. But, okay, any thoughts?
None in particular. I mean, I do think that I've never seen an issue with either rule from a constitutional point of view, but I have to admit I've not thought about it deeply either.
I don't know enough about the history, I guess, to know at the time of the founding what all the thoughts were about those.
Well, let me rephrase it. Can a judge, okay, so jury is not properly instructed on the elements. Should and you have a right to a jury trial, so one of the elements is not proven to the jury. Should a judge on review be able to say, well, the evidence is in the record, so it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because that is Nieder?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there may be a difference between constitutional errors on constitutional requirements and other sorts of error, like the admission of evidence in violation of the federal rules of evidence, and whether, since Congress could presumably not even have the federal rules of evidence and have some totally different system, it can also kind of say, well, if you make an error and it turns out not to be prejudicial under the harmless error rule, it's okay. Nieder's different because you have a constitutional right to have the jury decide each of these elements, so it's a little weird to say the judge can just, like, dispense with it.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, we have common ground on that. You know, it does boggle my mind that, you know, if a person is charged with committing a crime that has four elements and the judge neglects to advise on element three, even if there was evidence in the record, how we can say that defendant got a fair and impartial trial by jury is beyond me.
Some of those doctrines, though, I think, especially retroactivity doctrines on habeas, I'm not the first person to say this, but they helped the liberal program because they weren't going to get the votes to expand rights if that meant, like, you know, 20,000 people in prison were all going to be able to take advantage of this and get out of prison. Like, the moderate justices were not going to vote for that.
Like Johnson.
Johnson, yeah, exactly. But
sorry.
It's PTSD on that. But, no, but obviously, if it means that it's only going forward, that's a lot more palatable to people,
right,
and so forth. So.
Right, the parade of horribles. Yeah.
Any final comments?
Well, just on the instruction on the elements issue, I mean, so the interesting question for me is that, or the interesting confounding factor, is that the nature of criminal elements has changed since the founding, right? So the whole elemental approach to criminal law really was the invention of the Model Penal Code, by and large, in the 1950s. And so before that, I mean, crimes were all malum in se, and you would have standards like, you know, did he, you know, wickedly and maliciously, you know, do X, right? And so you weren't going to have, I would think, again, my gut instinct is that, you know, at the founding era, you wouldn't have a legalistic appeal, because no one's going to forget to say, was he wicked and malicious in murdering his mother-in-law or whatever, right? Whereas the Model Penal Code says, no, it's you have these five elements, you got to instruct on each of the five elements. We also have a lot of malum prohibitum crimes now that we didn't back then, where, you know, maybe the elements are more important because there's no way the person's going to know that what they're doing is wrongful. Whereas back at the founding era, they would have known because all the crimes were also sins, essentially. So anyway, it's a very I think it's a very interesting question on that level. It would involve a lot of thinking. Mm.
Any other final statements?
I'll say one thing, which is that to me, I'm a big fan of the current court. I think it's doing a fantastic job, and it's exactly the court I want to see. But I think that one danger when we're talking about precedent is a virtue of originalism has been that it's objective, or at least purports to be objective, and it's not the judge's policy preferences, debates about how much that's actually happening, but that's the supposed virtue. But if they don't have a really systemic, objective way of deciding which precedents they'll reconsider on originalist grounds and which they won't, that can easily bring in through the back door all the political bias and policy preferences that supposedly originalism gets rid of. And I don't know that the recent cases overruling precedents have given a super objective account of, you know, which precedents should be discarded and which ones, while wrong, are sufficient to keep. So I think that's a danger for the current court.
That's That's it. I noticed that. I mean, just in going through, because I was thinking about stare decisis, looking at Dobbs and Ramos and Casey. I mean, when it comes to like stare decisis, the court is almost as lawless as it is when it comes to standing. Like, it's just, you know.
Nothing's worse than standing. Yeah. Sorry, Judge. They make it up. It's all made up.
Yeah, it just expands and contracts and sort of, yeah. I completely agree with you.
Me too.
I agree as well. It's actually, like, because I practice in the district court and the appellate courts, I don't ask those judges to overrule cases because they don't have that power. But in reading these cases, it does also boggle my mind that 250 years later, we're still not, you know, on the same page as to why we would overrule a precedent. And, you know, this whole thing about not only should something be settled, but settled right is, you know, very malleable. So it's just very interesting in a person who just wants a stable and orderly society in which to live. Anyway.
Well, I want to thank, and I hope you will, our amazing panel. I also want to thank you all for actually asking questions. I've been in too many of these where people make speeches. And I would ask just one final instruction that I mentioned before. Please immediately leave the room, and then you can talk to the panel or amongst yourselves. Thank you.